E is for Evidence by Sue Grafton. Copyright 1988 by Sue Grafton. This recording of the full-length reading of E is for Evidence was published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Incorporated and was produced in 1994 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape Incorporated. This book is read by Mary Pfeiffer. Chapter 1. It was Monday, December 27th, and I was sitting in my office trying to get a fix on the mood I was in, which was bad, 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 comprised of equal parts irritation and uneasiness. The irritation was generated by a bank notice I'd just received, one of those windowed numbers with the yellow carbon showing through. At first I assumed I was overdrawn, but what I pulled out was a slip dated Friday, December 24th, showing a $5,000 deposit to my checking account. "What the hell is this?" I said. The account number was correct, but the deposit wasn't mine. In my experience, banks are the least helpful institutions on earth, and the notion of having to stop what I was doing to straighten out an error was nearly more than I could bear. I tossed the notice aside, trying to reclaim my concentration. I was getting ready to write up the preliminary report on an insurance case I'd been asked to look into, and Darcy, the secretary at California Fidelity, had just buzzed to say that Mac wanted the file on his desk right away. Mentally, I'd come up with a tart suggestion about what she could do with herself, but I'd kept my mouth shut, showing, I thought, admirable restraint. I turned back to my portable Smith Corona, inserting the proper form for a property insurance loss register. My nimble fingers were poised to type while I reviewed my notes. That's where I was stuck. Something was off, and I couldn't figure out what it was. I glanced at the bank notice again. Almost with an eye toward the comic relief, I called the bank, hoping the diversion would help me focus on what was bothering me about the situation at Wood Warren, a local company manufacturing hydrogen furnaces for industrial use. They'd had a fire out there on December 19th that had destroyed a warehouse. "Mrs. Brunswick, customer service, may I help you?" "Well, I hope so," I said. "I just received a notice saying I put $5,000 in my checking account last Friday, and I didn't do that. Is there any way you can straighten it out?"
"May I have your name and account number, please?"
"Kinsey Milhone," I said, supplying my account number in slow, measured tones. She put me on hold briefly while she called up the records on her computer terminal. Meanwhile, I listened to the bank's rendition of Good King Wenceslas, which I've personally never understood. What's the Feast of Stephen? Mrs. Brunswick clicked back in. "Miss Milhone, I'm not certain what the problem is, but we do show a cash deposit to this account number. Apparently it was left in the night deposit slot and posted over the weekend."
"You still have one of those night deposit slots?" I asked with amazement.
"At our downtown branch, yes," she said.
"Well, there's some kind of mistake here. I've never even seen the night deposit slot. I use my 24-hour instant teller card if I need to transact bank business after hours. What do we do now?"
"I can track down a copy of the deposit slip," she said skeptically.
"Would you do that, please? Because I didn't make a deposit of any kind last Friday, and certainly not $5,000 worth. Maybe somebody transposed some numbers on the deposit slip or something, but the money sure doesn't belong to me."
She took my telephone number and said she'd get back to me.
I could tell I was in for countless phone calls before the correction could be made. Suppose somebody was merrily writing checks against the $5,000.
I went back to the task at hand, wishing I felt more enlightened than I did. My mind kept jumping around. The file on the fire claim at Wood Warren had actually come into my hands 4 days before, late Thursday the 23rd. I'd been scheduled to have a farewell drink with my landlord, Henry Pitts, at 4, and then take him out to the airport and put him on a plane. He was flying back to Michigan to spend the holidays with his family, some of whom are edging into their 90s with their vigor and good spirit still in evidence. Henry's pushing 81, a mere kid, and he was about as excited as one at the prospect of the trip. I was still at the office that afternoon with my paperwork caught up and some time to kill. I went out onto my second-floor balcony, peering off to my right at the V of Pacific Ocean, visible at the foot of State Street, 10 blocks down. This is Santa Teresa, California, 95 miles north of Los Angeles. Winter here is a grand affair,
full of sunshine and mild temperatures, vibrant magenta bougainvillea, gentle winds, and palm trees waving fronds at the seagulls as they wheel overhead. The only signs of Christmas, 2 days away, were the garlands of tinsel strung along the main streets. The stores, of course, were packed with shoppers, and there was a trio of Salvation Army horn players tooting away at Deck the Halls. In the interests of feeling jolly, I thought I'd better work out my strategy for the next 2 days. Anyone who knows me will tell you that I cherish my unmarried state. I'm female, twice divorced, no kids, and no close family ties. I'm a private detective by trade. Usually I'm perfectly content to do what I do. There are times when I work long hours on a case, and times when I'm on the road, and times when I hole up in my tiny apartment and read books for days. When the holidays come around, however, I find that I have to exercise a certain cunning, lest the absence of loved ones generate unruly depression. Thanksgiving had been a breeze. I spent the day with Henry and some pals of his, who'd cooked and sipped champagne and laughed and told tales about days long past, making me wish I were their age instead of my own, which is 32. Now Henry was leaving town, and even Rosie, who runs the dingy neighborhood tavern where I often eat, was closing down until January 2nd, refusing to tell a soul what she meant to do with herself. Rosie is 66, Hungarian, short, top-heavy, bossy, and often rude, so it wasn't as though I was worried I'd miss any touching heart-to-heart chats. The fact that she was closing her eatery was simply one more uncomfortable reminder that I was out there in the world all by myself and had best find a way to look after me. At any rate, I'd glanced at my watch and decided I might as well head on home. I switched on the answering machine, grabbed my jacket and handbag, and was just locking up when Darcy Pascoe, the receptionist from the insurance company next door, popped her head in. I had worked for California Fidelity full-time at one point, doing investigations on fire and wrongful death claims. Now the arrangement is informal. I'm more or less on call, doing a certain number of investigations for them as needed, in exchange for downtown office space I couldn't otherwise afford.
"Oh, wow, I'm glad I caught you," Darcy said. "Mac told me to give you this."
She handed me a file, which I glanced at automatically. The blank form side indicated that I was being asked to do a fire scene inspection, the first in months.
"Mac did?"
Mac is the CFI's president. I couldn't imagine him handling routine paperwork.
"Well, actually, Mac gave it to Andy, and Andy said I should give it to you."
There was a memo attached to the file cover, dated 3 days before, and marked Rush. Darcy caught my look, and her cheeks tinted faintly.
"It was stuck under a big pile of stuff on my desk, or I'd have gotten it to you sooner," she said.
Darcy's in her late 20s, and something of a flake. I crossed to my desk, tossing the file on top of some others I was working on. I'd catch it first thing in the morning. Darcy lingered in the doorway, guessing my intent.
"Is there any way you can get to that today? I know he's anxious to get somebody out there. Jewel was supposed to handle it, but she's taking 2 weeks off, so Max said maybe you could do it instead."
"What's the claim?"
"A big warehouse fire out in Colgate. You probably heard it on the news."
I shook my head. "I've been down in L.A.
"Well, the newspaper clippings are in there, too. I guess they want someone out there super quick."
I was annoyed at the pressure, but I opened the manila folder again and checked at the property loss notice, which was posted on top. "Wood Warren," I said.
"You know the company?"
"I know the Woods. I went to high school with the youngest girl. We were in the same homeroom." She looked relieved, as if I'd just solved a problem for her.
"That's great! I'll tell Mac maybe you can get out there this afternoon."
"Darcy, would you knock that off? I've got to take somebody to the airport," I said. "Trust me, I'll make an appointment for the earliest possible moment."
"Oh, well, I'll make a note then, so they'll know you're taking care of it," she said. "I have to get back to the phones. Let me know when you have the report, and I'll come pick it up."
"Terrific," I said. She must have decided she had pushed me far enough because she excused herself and disappeared in haste. As soon as she left, just to get it over with, I put a call through to Wood Warren and arranged to meet with the company president, Lance Wood, at 9 o'clock the next morning, Christmas Eve day. Meanwhile, as it was 3:45, I tucked the file in my handbag, locked up, and headed down the back stairs to the lot where my VW was parked. I was home 10 minutes later. During our little pre-Christmas celebration, Henry gave me a new Len Dayton novel, and I gave him a periwinkle blue mohair muffler which I had crocheted myself, a little-known talent of mine. We sat in his kitchen and ate half a pan of his homemade cinnamon rolls, drinking champagne out of the matching crystal flutes.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?